Forward Guidance is brought to you by VanEck, a global leader in asset management since 1955. You'll be hearing more about VanEck ETFs later on, but for now, let's get into today's interview. Very pleased to welcome to Forward Guidance Jason Hsu, Chairman and Chief Investment Officer of Raliant. Jason, great to see you. How are you doing?
Hi, Jack. Glad to be on your show.
It's my pleasure. So, Jason, you are take a very quantamental approach to your investment framework. Tell us about the work you do in China. You've got a fund that invests in China, and you have a specific approach to screening out specific China companies. And I feel like what you screen is very interesting because the Chinese market is in a pretty brutal bear market. Is the phrase brutal? Is that too dramatic, or is that justified?
No, I think brutal is absolutely justified, and it's probably spot on. But so first and foremost, we're an emerging market expert. We really have our pedigree in the institutional space, running money for large sovereign funds, especially those that are in Asia. Where you run money for government of Taiwan and other large Asian government pension funds. And we kind of narrowed that down to single countries because we're getting mandates from these, individual country pension funds. China happens to be, one of the biggest markets. It happens to be a market where when we were launching our funds that had a lot of global interest, both positive and negative. And the methodology, the quantamental methodology, right? The quantitative screening plus sort of sensible model building applies really well in China. In fact, many of the quantitative models, something we in academic call factor models, that has stopped working in the US just because the US market's pretty efficient. Most of the, tricks that companies might play on the accounting side, most of the techniques for teasing out good companies, they don't work as well in the US because it's so competitive, it's been arbed out. But they work tremendously well in emerging markets, and they work really well in China. So, Jack, to your point, you use these accounting red flag tools that's been developed back in the 80s and 90s in the US. Like, they don't work in the US anymore, but they work really well in terms of helping you screen out companies that are problematic, whose numbers are not as reliable. They do a really good job in China to help you avoid those problem stocks.
What would be an example of that be? Of something where maybe the human eye can glance over it and miss it, but the algorithm that, the quant data analyzer spots some shenanigans and screens it out?
There are a few broad categories that we actually screen for. One is screening for the quality of the company. One screens for relative valuation. One screens for sentiment. So that's kind of look at, first of all, valuation, because I think that is easiest to understand. It works surprisingly well in all emerging markets and works super well in China. Screening for valuation is basically looking at, is this company cheap relative to the proper peer group? Is it cheap relative to its historical valuation range? And that tries to help you capture, market goes through valuation cycles, stocks go in and out of favors. And you're just like Warren Buffett says, right? You're going to be more successful over time on average if you buy cheap than if you buy expensive, right? It could be a great company, but if you pay too much for it, the return isn't going to be there. It might be a bad company, a lot of negative news, growth is slow, but if you pay a dirt cheap price for it, you might still come out ahead, right? So valuation is huge for us, and it works particularly well in emerging markets, really well in China, because their valuation swings are that much more dramatic, right? So cheap can get way too cheap, and overvalued can get way too overvalued. So you do want to use that signal, and that's probably one of the most powerful ones. Now, the next one that sort of interacts really well with valuation is quality, right? Because you don't want to buy a company that really is a bad company that's, on its way to death, right? Or it's a company that's forever cheap, right? You think of, state-owned utility companies, and there are lots of those in emerging markets, and certainly there's no lack of large state-owned enterprises that are just not very productive, right? So, if you buy a cheap company that is a state-owned enterprise that's rather dysfunctional, you'll never make money, right? Just be forever cheap. So you also want to screen for quality. So make sure that the growth characteristics are there as well, and it does have a healthy margin. There's a, profile earnings growth over time. And then that sort of valuation signal interacting with, growth, growth-related type quality metrics helps you, get at buying a growing cash flow at a big discount. Now, what's also important is, of course, sentiment, right? Because oftentimes something that is cheap maybe good quality. You could wait for 2 years before there is catalyst that causes it to be revalued, that causes analysts to come back and talk about that stock. Right? You don't want to wait too long because otherwise your capital is not very efficient. So it's also important to understand sentiment. And by looking at sentiment, looking at flows, looking at sort of new changes in sort of analyst recommendations, it also gets you a sense of, you know, are you near a catalyst that's about to sort of ignite and propel stock price upward?
For your China, RAYC, I believe is the ticker. Is it you also try and find companies that are owned by Chinese nationals, i.e. not foreign investors? It's not just like people in, you know, Greenwich, Connecticut, pouring money into Alibaba.
Yeah. So, you know, in our strategy, we look at obviously all the Chinese stocks. And what we have concluded is that really, you're going to buy a lot more of the sleeper stocks that no one's have heard of, companies that are still young in their growth cycle, buying what are called onshore, basically companies that are listed in domestic Chinese stock exchanges rather than kind of the Alibabas and Tencents, which by the time they list are already with the world's largest, you know, one of the world's largest tech companies, fully valued. Everyone's jumped on the bandwagon already, right? So we just believe in, look, you don't want to be buying a stock that everyone knows is great and you buy it when it's very expensive already, right? You want to go into the onshore local market where there's not a lot of competition from international capital, where there's more opportunity for alpha because the local retail investors make more mistakes. They don't understand a good thing when they see it, just lacking global investing experience. So that's where we focus. We just think, you know, if you buy the onshore shares, you might more likely buy something that'll grow to become much bigger. You have an advantage because you're trading against not international hedge funds, but really trading against sort of local retail investors. And the result of that is if you look at the performance of the onshore versus the offshore, the differential in returns is I think, cumulatively about 50, 60%.
Really? So like since inception?
So yeah, over the last 3 years. And that just tells you how different, you know, the offshore shares and the onshore shares can be in terms of performance.
Got it. So that would be when you launched this strategy 3 years ago, or because you launched a fund later, right? The ETF later. And I know they're different.
No, the ETF is now 3+ years in terms of track record. Yeah. So over the time that we have had the fund that has, you know, invested predominantly in the A shares, the performance between, say, a A shares company versus, say, the Alibaba and the Tencent, that the cumulative performance difference is night and day. It's enormous. If you've actually seen companies have actually delivered positive results at the same time where most of the offshore companies have had, you know, a minus 70% return.
So you don't own any shares that could be owned by foreign investors. You only own the A shares?
Generally, yes. Most of our portfolios would be shares that are hard to access and primarily onshore, because that's where we see opportunities are.
I mean, what is your sentiment on Chinese stocks so much? I mean, the bear market has been, as I said earlier, so brutal. The PE ratio, I mean, what is it? 11, 10? You tell me. Depends, obviously, which index you use.
Yeah.
Why have stocks going down so much? Is it represented in the earnings? Have the earnings been bad? I mean, I know there's a pretty severe real estate contraction there. How have you interpreted the very sharp fall in Chinese stocks? And then we'll get to your views going forward.
Yeah, Jack, it really is dominated by sentiment. Clearly, there's been a slowing down post COVID, obviously during COVID and all the way through to post COVID. So the slowdown in the underlying fundamental growth is absolutely there. But if you look at corporate earnings growth, right, year over year on average, it's actually growing, just not as fast as historically. What's really delivered this brutal negative performance the last 2-3 years has been sentiment, right? The Chinese shares, it's called the onshore shares, have historically traded at about 14 times earnings. So they've historically always traded at a lower multiple than, say, the S&P 500. And that's reasonable, right? S&P 500 is it's a more liquid market, safer market, so it trades at a higher valuation multiple. So the Chinese companies, despite the faster growth, actually trade a lower multiple to reflect the riskiness. Now, if you go from an average multiple of 14 times down to, you know, like a 2-standard deviation extreme, I think it was as bad as closer to being 8 times, right? You know, even if earnings is growing, you're going to have very bad returns because prices are falling, reflecting extreme pessimism, right? If you look at Chinese shares, be it the offshore one traded in Hong Kong, US, or onshore in China, there's a lot of fear being priced into it. I would say, what's priced into it? A conflict with the US via Taiwan, that's definitely priced into it. Worsening trade relationship with the US, US being one of China's biggest trade partners, right? And that's scary. A belief that somehow, you know, Beijing is going to abandon capitalism and perhaps go back to the way of central planning, right? Good, like very extreme and very irrational, but the fear is there. And so you have these fear all priced in, and that's really largely what's driving a very negative sentiment.
What is your view? Are you broadly bullish or bearish on the Chinese market? And what do you think could be a catalyst for the pain to end?
I would say I am a contrarian. So it's just important for people to understand why I have the kind of portfolio positioning I have is I'm a contrarian. So whenever I see an asset class that's just had tremendous headwind in terms of bad publicity, bad optics, negative press, I actually get a little excited. I go, okay, you know, things are probably not as bad as what's made out to be. Prices are probably too pessimistic. There's an opportunity there. So I like China right now because it is really, really cheap. And just the kind of headwind it has faced, real or imaginary, are enormous and probably overblown. And so I like it for that reason. So when you ask catalyst, right, what will it take for sentiment to shift? And when I say it's sentiment rather than sort of actual fundamental economic damage, like real estate is an issue. The slower growth post-COVID is an issue. But it's not like, you know, China is now experiencing what the U.S. experienced in 2007, where, you know, people are being foreclosed on, right? You know, this is a country where people buy real estate 100% on cash, part regulatory and, you know, lack of cheap financing. So, you know, people feel a little poor that, you know, real estate prices has come down, but, you know, people are not losing their home, not getting margin call. And so, you know, a lot of this feeling poor is quite sentiment driven. So sentiment is a little easier to fix, right? You're more likely to get a catalyst that could fix sentiment. But in China, that usually historically, if you look at cycles, it comes down to the state spending. And it's not like simple rate cutting monetary policy. It really is the state going out there and say, okay, households, if you're not going to spend money, what we're going to do is we're going to send money for you. And so it's going to be targeted government spending in the key areas and sectors. And that will gradually then sort of kickstart. And depending on how big that package is, the speed of it getting sort of rebooted can be faster or slower.
So you said earlier that the people who buy houses, they're buy exclusively with cash in China.
So in China, so I'll give you a funny anecdote, right? So in China, your first home, you could put 30% down and finance. Now, financing costs in China is meaningfully higher than in the US historically. So, you know, people actually do have to commit down a meaningful down payment and have the cash to cover interest, right? So there's none of that US ninja loan during our real estate crisis, right? Now, if you want to buy a second unit, in most cities and provinces, that is actually forbidden. And so it's actually quite funny. In China, you have to go down to a lot of households go down to the city hall to get a fake divorce so they can buy a second home. And so if you're actually, you know, at city hall filing for a divorce, they actually would ask you, are you here to buy another apartment? That's why you want a divorce, or do you actually need, you know, marriage counseling because you have a, you know, marital problem? So if you're actually getting a divorce to buy another apartment, like you just go to that line and we'll get a process. And if you're actually getting a real divorce, you have to go get marriage counseling. And so the government has actually been trying really hard to prevent any speculation. And so from forbidding you to buy a second unit to you buy a second unit, you just can't get financing, right? It has to be 100% cash down.
And Jason, but is that, you can't buy a second home, is that new or has that been in place for a long
time? No, that's been there for a long time.
Okay, so who are the speculators who are buying all of these apartment buildings then?
So when people say, oh, people are speculating, they are speculating, just they're speculating with cash. So you want to think of it as people in China buy real estate as a store of value, much like, mm-hmm. you know, say my Indian friends, they buy gold as a store of value, right? Yep. They don't expect gold to, you know, breed and provide little gold nuggets as dividends, right? They don't expect it to be productive, right? Just like Chinese people, they buy real estate, you know, they don't rent it out for additional income. It's not investment property. It's a store value. Just it happens to be real estate rather than gold. You know, it's equally displayable as a display of wealth, I guess. And so people in China who buy many, many apartments, it's not on leverage, right? They actually just have a lot of cash that they put in a bank and then they would put into real estate. Actually, a tiny, tiny fraction of their wealth goes into the stock market, right? Stock market for the Chinese is still not viewed as a channel for wealth storage or wealth growth.
Is that encouraged by the Chinese government? Is that, you know, why is it in America that, you know, people say, oh, I've got some savings, I'll maybe put a little bit in real estate, but I definitely want to, you know, participate in the stock market. Whereas in China, they mostly steer towards the real estate market. Is it, you know, go back to history? Is it encouraged by the government? Why is that the case?
I think it's very cultural. So it probably has to do with you know, the fact that, you know, the Chinese stock market hasn't existed for a very long time, right? Like in the US, you can trace the stock market all the way back to the early 90s. The craziness in the past is all old history, and it's actually been a stable, wealth-creating market, right, for most people. Now, in China, like the Shanghai Stock Exchange only reopened for business about 20 plus years ago. And for the first 5-10 years, it only listed a few big state-owned enterprises. So it wasn't, you know, it's nothing like the S&P 500 where you can buy into, you know, great entrepreneurs and great product companies, right? Mm-hmm. And so stock market is a very new thing for the Chinese. And I would say because it's so retail in nature, because, you know, China doesn't have its big pension funds investing in the stock market just yet. Because, again, pension in China is pay as you go. So, you know, there's not a lot of assets stored in its retirement market. So it's a very retail-oriented market. And as a result, prices fluctuate way too much. Retail doesn't always understand fundamentals. So oftentimes it could be a story stock that gets too overhyped, that runs up and crashes. So from people's experience, it feels a little more like casino than it does like sensible investing. So I don't think there's a great preference for real estate, but there's probably more of a distrust for the stock market.
Okay, that's interesting. And so you said you made a contrast, you know, unlike the subprime bubble of 2005 or 6 in the US, when people who were buying property were buying it with credit that they, you know, probably or may not be able to pay back, the Chinese speculator, the Chinese buyer of property is buying it with cash that they have. Okay, but there is a tremendous amount of leverage in the Chinese real estate system, right? It's just on the developer's side who are now going bankrupt and, you know, the dominoes are falling. Tell us about that side.
Yeah, if you're going to blow leverage, right, it's a little bit better and a little easier to handle when it's on the developer side than the household side, right? Because when it's the household, it becomes kind of a national crisis and a social issue. On the developer side, essentially, a lot of developers are heavily geared. So Jack, you're absolutely right. A lot of developers, you know, unlike the US, where like if you're developing a giant community, right, you kind of build four homes, sell those four homes, you get paid, you build another four homes. It takes a while to build a whole community. Like the Chinese developers just have multiple sites all going at the same time, assuming they can always sell it, they can always get financing. And so some of them are geared up, like not, you know, what we're talking about 20-to-1 type of gearing, right? And so a lot of developers who's now gone under, it's not because their property is no good. They no one wants to buy you know, the project they're developing. It's that the government is so afraid of how this might unwind badly. The government basically said, if you're too geared up, right, you just can't renew your financing. You have to sell your project to someone. You either complete it and sell it or sell it to another developer that isn't as geared up. And so it's been this almost engineered bankruptcy for the super geared up developers. And what's actually now happening is the bank is then facilitating a transfer of these projects to developers that are less leveraged. So my, you know, from our own data and research, you know, most of the projects are high enough quality that they will be bought and taken over by developers that have the balance sheet to do it. Many developers will go under, but the project themselves will actually be completed and delivered. There's going to be delay and people are going to be anxious about that, but it's not going to spill over.
What do you think the effect on the Chinese economy will be of multiple very large developers? I mean, Evergrande, the biggest property developer in the world, I think, you know, going bankrupt, other Chinese property developers going bankrupt, and particularly Chinese citizens who bought houses and property with cash and they've already paid the money, but the project isn't being developed. That's what you referenced, I think, when you said talked about delays. What are the spillovers that have we seen in the Chinese economy already? And what do you think is coming on the way?
Even if this is not kind of on the scale of our kind of global financial crisis, our real estate crisis of 07, I would say the psychological impact cannot be understated, because for a very long time, Chinese households just assume, look, if I store value in real estate always goes up. So, you know, there's this income effect and wealth effect coming through the real estate channel. It's the first time for them to first experience the other direction and to go kind of into this fear state that it may not ever go back to the old days where real estate is such a reliable creator of wealth. And I think that's creating tremendous angst for people. Not only have they seen their sort of wealth fallen because real estate prices have fallen as a result of, you know, the developers going bankrupt, but there's just sort of this confidence about, well, what is the future for all real estate or for real estate prices? If I can't rely on real estate as a way to create wealth, well, what am I going to do given, you know, bank deposit yields is now 2.5% and the stock market is too volatile. So I think all of a sudden you have this very sort of negative sentiment because people sort of entering a new phase where they don't actually know how to generate sort of passive wealth increase.
Do you think that Chinese property prices, you know, which I believe have fallen somewhat, do you think that they will continue to fall?
I would say it's hard to say. I would certainly say it's less liquid now because it used to be a buying frenzy, right? It used to be for you to buy real estate, right? The government really tries to stop you. And it becomes a lottery system, right? You have to win a lottery before you're given the opportunity to buy an apartment. So that's all largely gone away, except for the most premium trophy, luxury apartments. So, you know, certainly the kind of frenzy, the liquidity, you know, we probably won't see that returning anytime soon. Now, do we go into sort of long-term downward trend? I also don't think so as well. Again, right, there's no forced selling, and most people in China have been sort of buying, they were buy and hold. So you don't have a lot of sort of selling pressure. And you actually continue to have sort of buying demand as young people. You know, one of the prerequisites for getting married is you need to, you know, buy an apartment and move into your own place. So they'll, you know, as people continue to go, you know, mature into the marriage age, right, demand is always going to be there. So, you know, I don't see a risk to the downside, but I would also agree that the kind of run-up that was experienced before is unlikely to return either.
Is it fair to say that Chinese property prices in the past, at least, were well above historical norms for the rest of the world? Like I'm looking at, you know, Shanghai price to income ratio of 45. So that means
it's completely unreasonable, right? I mean, if you look at Shanghai, Shanghai and Beijing are probably the extremes, and you can map that to, you know, the premium, you know, locations in Hong Kong, Taipei, Seoul, Tokyo. It's right up there, right? And then you factor in the fact that, you know, the per capita income is sort of lower in China, right? Just the unaffordability is a tremendous issue for China, as it's true for most of the other Asian economies. This is actually a more of a social problem than it is a financial problem for most Asian countries.
It is a social problem. Tell us about the impact you think this will have on the banking system. Because if, you know, property developers, if they go bankrupt or if they have to, you know, attempt to renegotiate a loan, it doesn't just hurt them. Often it's the bank who, you know, will end up holding the property. And if their collateral is a property that's overvalued, that could have a severe impact to the banking system. Of course, the nightmare scenario is that the true value of the assets is less than the liquid liabilities and it's insolvent. And there's a bank run. So I guess there's, you know, insolvency and then there's a liquidity crisis. Maybe let's start off just with the liquidity crisis. What are the what are the odds or propensities of a bank run in China?
When you mention these sort of spectacular bank runs, they actually become the reason why we will see less bank runs, and certainly for China, because the U.S. have probably demonstrated beyond doubt that if you have a central bank that can print your own currency, and you sort of leap into action, first sign of trouble, and just commit to backing banks, you know, with unlimited resources, you can stem a bank run on day one, right? I think the U.S. learned that during the global financial crisis and demonstrated that in spades when Silicon Valley Bank and First Republic Bank, started experiencing bank runs. So I think the Chinese sort of learned that. And again, they got obviously their own currency that they can print. They got a very, very strong balance sheet. And so they're actually quite credible when they say they can back any bank that's in trouble, whether due to liquidity reasons or actual structural reasons. So I'd say the U.S. has sort of taught China how to deal with that. And I don't expect a bank run.
So the People's Bank of China has tons of very, very, very liquid assets. You know, no one's worried about People's Bank of China running out of money, but I'm talking about the banking system, the commercial banks, some of which are state-owned, some of which are publicly traded, but I think, the government is still very heavily involved. You can tell us a little bit about that. There's a sense that the Chinese government really controls the banking system, so they would prevent. Is that true?
That is true. I mean, if you rank the banks, from 1 to 100, you can probably see that, top 80 are all either directly owned or significantly owned and then therefore significantly controlled by the state. This is really a case where you can think of them as an extension of the People's Bank of China, right? So the central bank will always come out and back these banks. Even if there's, enough sort of private shareholders in there, I think the government has made it very clear that they will back banks to avoid any kind of systemic crisis from sort of a bank run.
Got it. Okay, so that's the liquidity front. Now tell us about solvency. If, a lot of the banks have been making a tremendous amount of commercial real estate loans to developers whose the collateral is, projects that are valued at 40 price to income, is there a risk that, a lot of the Chinese banking system is insolvent if prices go down and the people who are borrowing money from them go bankrupt?
So I would say the one party that's been most concerned by that and have spent the most time trying to study, how do you deflate that bubble without blowing things up, is actually Beijing. I can tell you, Beijing's biggest fixation is how to avoid the Japanese type, a real estate bubble from crushing the economy. And of course, later on, how to avoid the U.S. global financial crisis type of a real estate induced and systemic bubble. This is why it's actually before it sort of rolled out the three red line to deleverage the real estate builders. They sort of done simulation to see, how much have all my banks actually lent out to these people? What's in the shadow banking? What's sort of direct lending? And is there a path to gradually deflate that? And so they've done all these simulations and kind of figure out what is the maximum paying that they can take and how much they need to back it if things don't go so well. That was all sort of taken into account before they laid out the three red line policy of if you go above this line, you can't get refinancing, right? Because they kind of know, if the line was too aggressive, then too many, developers are going to get in trouble all at the same time and they probably can't handle that. And so it was actually a very carefully, so that's why I said it's an engineered bankruptcy, the Evergrande. And they've sort of done stress testing to know that they can handle that. So it's not like a disorderly bankruptcy. Are some of the banks taking a haircut? Absolutely, right? And it's sort of punishment for making unwise loans. What you're also now seeing is a lot of the haircut is actually borne by Evergrande's equity shareholder and Evergrande's sort of debt holders before the bank sort of actually takes their haircut, right? Because the way in which this is structured is the banks actually held on to collateral. And so, the equity value gets destroyed first and the bank can sort of take whatever, the Evergrande has and then, sell the collateral to the next developer and hoping they recover, if not the full amount, at least 80-70% of that. Now, still painful experience for sure.
How would you characterize, it sounds like you're somewhat bullish on the broad equity market in China just because things are so cheap. How would you say you are more or less bullish on the banking system?
I would say I am bullish on the sort of top state-owned banks, the really blue chip top state-owned banks, because they're the ones that sort of participate in the stress testing, right? They're the one that have always been in full communication with Beijing about what is coming down the pikes, the kind of, you know, right down that they might face. And so if you look at them, they have always had classified on their balance sheet a lot of bad loans. And it's not because, you know, they've made so many bad loans and so they're forced to sort of recognize bad loans, right? They've always been making provisions because they kind of knew what policy is coming forth. And by making such a large provision, they kept more of the internal cash flow. They artificially make it such that they can't make more loans. So actually the balance sheet and the bad loan that's actually on the book is sort of far less than what has been disclosed. The disclosure is actually significantly more aggressive because they knew what might be coming. So in fact, as an anecdote, a very good friend of mine who was a bank executive, they said they actually tried to reclassify a lot of good loans as bad loans so that the bank would have would just have this automatically know to anyone pressuring the bank to lend out more money to help out a real estate developer so they can sort of push off that kind of local political pressure. That just sort of tells you, like, they already know what might be coming and they have sort of erected self-defense mechanism. They're of course now all being traded as if they're likely to experience systemic crisis, or there could be a bank run, or they could lose significant amount of their balance sheet as a result of bad debt. But I would say that first of all has already been provisioned for, and second of all, again, that risk is overinflated.
So would you say a lot of the banks in China are trading at distressed prices? Because if I look at a stock like Tencent or Alibaba, I would say their 5-year stock pattern actually looks more in a bear market than many Chinese banks, and definitely U.S. banks, like New York Community Bank, for example. Are there any Chinese stocks that are trading at down 95%? Because we have banks like that in the
not the banks. Yeah. So, first of all, the people in China recognize that the banks will always be bailed out, and the largest shareholder of all these banks are the state, right? So favorable policies and tailwinds. So they generally trade with a little bit of that the government put embedded in there. So they tend to hold their value well. Now, of course, they still trade at very, very cheap valuation multiple versus kind of their monopoly position and versus the amount of cash flow they have. So if you just look at if you look at the stocks that have had poor performance, yes, the banks are certainly not the worst performers, certainly versus the tech. But I would say, if you say who is more likely to be trading at a distressed valuation relative to potential, I would say for banks, it's very obvious. For the tech companies, it's less obvious in the following sense, right? The headwind that the tech companies face, twofold, right? One is regulatory, and I think the regulatory one is significantly reduced. But the other one is a lot of the newer tech platforms in China have simply taken advantage of the last 3 years and really took market share away from the Alibabas, right? Just look at Pinduoduo, right? I mean,
yep.
This they're tiny relative to Alibaba 3 years ago, and their performance the last 3 years is something like plus 100%, right? They've doubled their stock price, whereas Alibaba's probably fallen 65%. So it just says a lot of this is not just Alibaba and regulatory headwind, because Pinduoduo is also a e-commerce platform, right? A lot of it is also because newer technology, perhaps one that's, sort of better suited for the post-COVID environment, has taken a lot of market shares away from the dominant players. And that's something we should factor in, right? Because that's not just sentiment, right? That's actually pure competition.
Yeah, I think Pinduoduo is the biggest retailer in China, right?
Probably by transactions, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Not market cap, yeah. It has surpassed Alibaba, which is very surprising. Tell us about the technology platform. You said that the regulatory scrutiny on many tech platforms was reduced. What did you mean by that?
The regulators have gone from being very antagonistic, right? And it's antagonistic on multiple fronts, all the way from, hey, you are actually not a Chinese company because you're listed offshore, and all of your profit goes to this Cayman shell company through the VIE structure. So from challenging their corporate governance, corporate structure, and their listing venue, to then challenging them on data security. It's like, look, you might not actually be a Chinese company, so we can't regulate you like a Chinese company. And so this is a foreign company who owns a lot of sensitive, you know, Chinese private citizen data. And so they're sort of going after these tech platforms from just a variety of different directions, right? You know, so that was true of Uber that sort of listed. It's true of Alibaba that has already been listed and trading for a while. Now, I think that has largely eased off, right? You don't see regulators making an issue of that because those issues really haven't been addressed, but the regulators are no longer sort of latching on to that to make an issue of it. So this is what I mean by that headwind seems to have sort of eased off or ceased completely.
And is that also true of the high-profile crackdown in, let's say, online tutoring, that kind of stuff? Is that crackdown largely over?
Yeah. So a funny thing is the person who was in charge of sort of putting that in place has since then been fired. And now sort of tutoring has sort of come back to life, right? So the regulators has clearly gone the other direction because when it was first sort of put in place, it was any kind of, you know, online education, offline tutoring was not allowed. Now they've sort of redefined everything. And I would say, you know, other than probably a very narrow set of tutoring activities that is not allowed, everything else is sort of, you know, back to where it was before. And then you've seen that the company EDU, right? That was the biggest player and probably the most iconic. Their share price have recovered very, very significantly right there. I think, you know, you give it probably another few upper limit days and it's back to where it was.
So if I believe looking at your ETF, I believe I don't see Tencent or Alibaba. Why are you not invested in those companies? And why do you think the stocks that you do own in your ETF, what is better about those stocks that that Tencent and you know the other mega stocks that are traded in the U.S. don't have?
Well, so first of all, these tech giants, you know, they're already trading at fairly rich valuation, even though it's come down a lot. But historically, they've always traded more the NASDAQ type valuation than the domestic valuation, right? And you kind of go, look, you know, can I buy domestic consumer growth-oriented themes at a 30% discount versus what I can buy in terms of a Alibaba or Tencent, and you look domestically, yes, absolutely, right? Just to give you an example, you know, most people think, oh, you know, the only way to create wealth in China must be from tech IPOs, you know, technology shares. But no, for a long time, the wealthiest person in China right now is the guy who sells water. The last one was the guy who sold hot pot, right? So, you know, growth in China is not just tech, right? Growth in China is just anything and everything that's on the consumer side. And there are just a lot of those names domestically that are smaller and much cheaper.
So Alibaba and Tencent with their PEs of, I just looked, 12 or 13, those are too expensive for you.
Because I can get something comparable that's growing faster, cheaper, I'm sure. Now, at 12 and 13 is still much better, right? It's still much better than where they were at, you know, at 20 plus before.
Like gold did, Bitcoin is establishing itself as a macro asset that potentially helps hedge against the government devaluation of your money. Finally, you can easily access Bitcoin in a low-cost ETF with the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, ticker HODL. Search the ticker HODL in your brokerage app today. Visit VanEck.com/HODLFG to learn more. That's VanEck.com/HODLFG. Now the disclosures. Investing involves risk and you could lose money on an investment in the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, also known as the Trust or HODL. The value of Bitcoin and therefore the value of the Trust shares could decline rapidly, including to zero. You could lose your entire principal investment. For a more complete discussion of the risk factors relative to the Trust, carefully read the prospectus link below. Thanks, let's get back to the interview. Yo, Jason, when do you think historians or you know, market participants 5 years from now, 10 years from now, do you think that people will look at right now as the bottom in Chinese equities?
I definitely think so. I mean, the market is too large to go away, right? I mean, you're talking about it being the world's factory, right? That is not changing anytime soon. Its per capita GDP stands at 13,000 and continues to grow as they sort of gain efficiency, gain productivity. Yeah, I mean, so I think everything else that people are afraid of right now is more noise. It's not that they're not meaningful, they're not important, but I think once you look at a longer time scale, they'll feel more like noise. You know, the emerging of one of the world's hardest working economy, right? It's called one of the world's hardest working economy. You know, I think that'll continue. And when you have a hardworking, productive economy, it'll drive wealth creation, it'll drive growth, and that's going to filter its way through to the stock market.
You said China will continue to be the world's factory. I want to explore that a little bit because there are efforts to move production either back to, you know, the US or Mexico, or, you know, maybe Apple is going to move a little bit to India. But at the same time, China itself, is it not trying to move up the value chain and saying, no, we're not going to just, yep. you know, we don't want to produce like plastic toys. Let's produce the best electric vehicles in the world, which, you know, by some accounts that they are. I noticed, you know, you have BYD in your ETF. How will that change of China attempting to move up the value chain, as well as you know, non-Chinese companies maybe diversifying their supply chains and production lines away from China? How is that going to impact the future of the Chinese economy?
So I would say friendshoring is accelerating a lot of things that would have happened, you know, just on its own pace anyways, right? Because to understand, you know, what is in store for China the next, you know, 10 years, you can just go back and look at what happened to Japan once it got sort of very developed and its per capita GDP was quite high and it was starting to make things that are you know, not just low cost OEM, but really, you know, global quality, right? And then later on, you got Taiwan and South Korea. China is sort of at that point, right? It is no longer just dirt cheap, right? Today, you manufacture in China, not because it's dirt cheap. It's because, wow, it's really good quality for a really competitive price. And no one can sort of get that price quality ratio just right. So, you know, China has been trying to push out a lot of manufacturing. It doesn't want to make t-shirts or jeans or, like you say, plastic toys. That's being pushed out to many other parts of Asia, to Mexico. Now with friendshoring, there's just sort of an acceleration of that trend that was already happening, right? For your audience who's been to Europe, just go to Italy, right? Two-thirds of Italian textile manufacturer, fashion manufacturer, are now owned and operated by the Chinese.
In China, or it's Chinese owning factories in Italy?
So okay. China has moved its factory to Italy.
Right? Very interesting.
Because they can take kind of their experience in running factories, and now this would be made in Italy, right? Gives you a higher brand, you know, better margin, and that the same thing is happening. And you've seen that in the trade data, that Mexico, now U.S. biggest trade partner, but like how the heck did that happen, right? Well, it's because now you're seeing a lot of Chinese manufacturers moving their factory to Mexico, benefiting from NAFTA, the proximity to the U.S. And, you know, these are Chinese operated factories. So with all the operational efficiency and look, it's just part of China understanding friendshoring and implications. These clever entrepreneurs, right? You expect clever Chinese entrepreneurs to be very plugged into where can they go to cost down, to reduce frictions, to maintain the business that they currently have. So, you know, I'm not too worried about the Chinese manufacturers. They will move their factories.
Jason, what is the cheapest Chinese stock in your China strategy, or one of the cheapest, either in your ETF or your non-publicly traded strategies? Like, how cheap are we talking? You know, PEs of 4, 3.
Yeah. I mean, we are seeing some of the manufacturers who are really trading at the absolute cyclical bottom, who are kind of at the PE of 4.
That's cheap.
And when that sort of cycle sort of, you know, reverses, you will kind of see them go back to at least historical norm, if not, you know, with a bit of a bull market behind them, perhaps, you know, to the historical highs. And there, you're not just banking on earnings per share growth. You're really benefiting from this shift in sentiment and therefore shift in valuation multiple.
Jason, earlier you said that you know, many Chinese citizens who accumulate savings tend not to put it in the stock market. So that, you know, that makes sense now with the Chinese equity market so beaten up. But there was a time where Chinese equities were trading very richly, I think of, you know, early 2021. So if it wasn't the Chinese you know, savings, who was bidding up these Chinese shares? Was it the hedge fund people in America?
So this just sort of gives you a sense of scale, right? The Chinese, so when you're talking about, like, you know, in 2020, 2021, when the market was quite exuberant, you know, the stock market, Chinese stock market at that time was about 13 trillion in size. So, you know, not quite the US, you know, at 40, but it was still the world's second largest stock market and then very liquid. And that was 95, 98% all sort of Chinese investors, either through mutual funds or directly through their own brokerage account, right? So it's, you know, for, we should just acknowledge this, like foreign flows into China is tiny relative to some of the domestic wealth that's in the market. Well, what's interesting is that is still a tiny fraction of the household wallet. The Chinese household oversaves excessively, right? If you think of the American household savings rate is borderline negative, right? The Chinese household savings rate is like 30%, right? And at the speed which the GDP is growing, the size of the GDP, they save a lot of money, right? By some estimate, right? And then sort of, you know, you got to take this with a grain of salt. Between what's directly in bank deposits and things that are quasi-bank deposits, you know, there's about $30 trillion worth of cash-like things just sitting there, right? And then you tag on real estate, right? So by comparison, the equities market is small versus the other storage of value.
So it has been mainly Chinese citizens selling shares.
Yes.
So I think, you know, from a non-Chinese perspective, we're very familiar with those narratives. But within China, what, you know, if you talk to someone who said, "Oh yeah, I used to be invest in the stock market, but then I sold a little bit, or I stopped investing." What are the sort of narratives that people tell themselves within China?
Within China, people are probably more pessimistic about their own stock market and about kind of their own economic growth and economic growth policies than I would say even foreigners, right? Like, so this is not, Americans are pessimistic about China and therefore they're selling their Chinese ETF and it's crashed the Chinese market. That is not at all what's happening, right? It's the domestic sentiment being even more negative. Right. And the funny thing is, right, I mean, the Chinese recognize if they want a balanced view, they should read global newspapers. Right? So the Chinese read a lot of American reportings about what's going on in China, right? And that freaks them out. Right? And so the sentiment is very, very fragile, very negative. But also, we've seen that before, right? Like the sentiment swing in China is very extreme. Right? Again, these are very short-term capital. They're not long-term pension funds that can sort of ignore the noise and not have the prospective history, right? These are all retail individuals who've probably forgotten, you know, what 2020 was like and only remembers kind of the last 2 months of pain in their own, you know, stock portfolio.
Right. As a quantitative investor, what moves the Chinese market? And for example, you know, if someone were to ask me or ask you what moves the US equity market, obviously in the long term, it is earnings and economic growth and inflation, stock buybacks, dividend, that sort of things. But you know, on an intraday basis, Jay Powell has a meeting and he says some pretty dovish things, the stock market's probably going to go up. If there's a inflation print that comes out and it's lower than expected, you know, in the inflationary time that we've been in, that's probably going to be bullish. If there's a huge inflationary beat, inflation is higher than expected as it was in 2022, probably going to drive the stock market down. Obviously, you know, it's very hard to predict these things. Like if you could predict this thing, it'd be easy to make money in the stock market, which of course it isn't. But we have a general sense of like what moves the stock market up and down. In China, what is it? I mean, are people listening to the People's Bank of China meeting? Are they looking at the economic data? What moves markets?
Well, it's about the same things, right? Over the long run, and unfortunately, this is true in China as well. Over the long run, companies have to make money, right? You got to have earnings growth, right? You got to have positive cash flow, right? You got to have a product out there that people want to buy. So in the long run, it's exactly the same thing, right? You cannot just hype up a stock based on a story and expect that to go on forever. But on any given day, right, really it's dominated by macro, like, so, you know, the equivalent of a Jay Powell, right, would be the People's Bank of China. This would be this regular saying that it'll be, you know, the National Party Congress and kind of the transcript for what was said and people tea leaf reading. So in the short run, it's a lot of, you know, noise that's more kind of macro in nature and a lot of gossip about individual companies and industries that moves prices.
Yeah. It's all gossip. That is really interesting. So you invest your firm Raylient, you invest not just in China, but all emerging markets, developed markets too. How has the emerging market universe, which of course by definition is not a monolith, how has that sort of index advanced and performed as China has really lagged behind? Because China was a 40% component of 30% of most emerging market indices, and you know, India has been doing well, but you know, India was not that big of a part, and maybe it's a bit bigger now, but what has it been like where, you know, the biggest constituent of EM has been such a laggard? China.
Yeah. And so Jack, first and foremost, you hit on a super important point, right? Like if you just held on to like a EM basket passively, right? Then you kind of just index it. What you would have had is like at the height of China where everyone loves China, everyone thinks China's going to overtake the US, you'd have almost 50% of EM portfolio in China, and India would be tiny. But then of course, right? Kind of it's like maximal allocation to the most thematic story stock. And you know you're going to do poorly, right? Because the sentiment swings, the cycles, right? It means, you know, when everyone's sort of too in love with something, it tends to do poorly later. And then you get too pessimistic. First of all, you got to be a bit more active and then sort of think it through, right? You know, obviously having 50% of EM in China is just too risky, too concentrated. And then betting way too big on China continuing on this path and not having much allocation to India sort of misses the point, right? It's like, look, you know, India has a great opportunity to follow the Chinese trajectory and to evolve and go from a per capita income of 3,000 eventually to 13,000, right? Yeah. So China's been the biggest lagger and really drag down EM performance, right? Without China, EMX China performance is actually quite respectable, right? Last year, you would have done 20-something at a time when China did minus 25%, right? If you were to take that out. So we are a big proponent that you need to look at the friendshoring theme and understand, well, what does that mean other than it's a headwind for China, but what does that mean as a tailwind for Mexico, as a tailwind for the rest of Southeast Asia, as a tailwind for the more developed part of EM, like Taiwan and South Korea.
So Taiwan and South Korea are part of EM.
Yes, they still are. Even though they really shouldn't be, right? Per capita income perspective, on just the quality of kind of their products, you know, they probably are more advanced than many European countries, but it's just legacy reasons they're still stuck in the EM basket.
If I were to ask the same question I asked about what moves the Chinese market, what moves EM markets? And if I were to, you know, say the 2000 to 2007 emerging markets did exceptionally well.
Awesome.
And then 2009, you know, the previous decade after that, 2009 to 2019, they kind of were somewhat of a laggard. What was different about those two decades where in the first one, they crushed it, and the second one, they were doing not so hot?
Cycles, right? I mean, these macro cycles are much longer than kind of individual stock market cycles. And, you know, EM had that almost 10-year stretch before the global financial crisis sort of caused a insane flight to safety, insane flight to capital that destroyed a lot of the EM currency. So before that major crisis, you know, EM was going through a wonderful cycle where, you know, they're hitting on all cylinders, from some of the resource-oriented economies to the value-add economies, you know, the Southeast Asian economies. So they're hitting on all cylinders. But really, the undoing was the U.S. global financial crisis. Even though it's a crisis of our own doing, it actually triggered a currency crisis, flight to safety, flight to capital that actually destroyed some of these more fragile economies. And then, of course, the U.S. recovered better and recovered because of the tremendous social media based technology platform sort of growth cycle. Now if you believe in cycles, right? Like it one could argue, right? Like, you know, the cycle of EM underperformance has been a bit over than 10 years. And given how cheap it is, it might be the cycle of EM again. And so you really want to look at kind of the future of EM as, you know, well, is there a thesis for the resource dominated EM economy to have another sort of resource boom, for the manufacturing export dominated economy, right? You know, do they have kind of is there a thesis for that to sort of outperform? And I would say on the resource side, at least, like we're going into a world where geopolitical tension stays high, remains high, and we seem to be adding to it. So I think resource based EM will continue to see high prices, high demand, and high global attention to get access to them. And that's definitely a tailwind for them. So I'm actually quite positive about that part of EM. And then I would say on the manufacturing part of EM, right, if the China friendshoring continues, right, even if China keeps 90% of its business, right, just like 10% of that massive flow would buoy up Mexico, Vietnam, and Indonesia tremendously. So I think that's quite exciting, especially now if you think of like AI and the requirement on the hardware side, right? That's just be honest, right? Like what manufacturing companies in Asia need is major US innovation, right? Because like innovation is just not something Asia is known for. It's known for engineering, right? It's known for making what's already made in the US just cheaper and a lot more of it. So, you know, NVIDIA is sort of demonstrating like the new hardware demand, right? Very soon Asia will figure out how to do that, and they'll just do that at a third of the price. And that's going to drive another manufacturing and tech boom in kind of the export-oriented part of Asia. And that'll be great for EM as well. So I'm seeing sort of at least two meaningful catalysts for two parts of EM.
The resource-rich emerging market, that would be Brazil. What other countries would be in that basket of resource-rich EMs?
So, you know, a lot of LATAM are mm-hmm. quite resource-rich, you know, and certainly the Middle East, you know, energy being such a strategic component. Africa, you know, there's so much mining of cobalt that is critical for making batteries. So these regions are going to be a big beneficiary.
So tell me about Africa. You know, if I look at, you know, one of the mainstream emerging market index or ETF, I'm pretty sure like all of the countries, you know, it comes a while before I see any country in Africa. I mean, it's maybe South Africa, but you know, the weightings are so small, and I don't think the stock markets are that developed. So would that be considered more frontier markets? I mean, I know that the terms don't really matter, but how much of the emerging market average beta basket is countries in Africa, and what are your views on it?
I would say the EM over time, the resource rich ones have become such a small component of the EM, right? And then, you know, be it Africa, be it Middle East, be it LATAM, right? If you kind of go, oh, you know, that just round out countries are too small in the basket, you would actually have very few left. And again, I would say that's just a index design bug rather than a useful feature, right? You really want to say, look, we just care about sort of less developed countries where if they just get a few things right and sort of run with it, they can do really, really well, right? And so that's how we think about EM, right? So we don't think about frontier versus EM. We really think of the countries are less developed and we're a little bit more of capital, just getting a few products right, getting some infrastructure right, they can create a lot of wealth. So that's how we think about it.
What's it like having a sort of quantitative model of investing in so many different companies, where, you know, I presume if you're invested in, you know, 100 companies, you're not on a first name basis with the management from every company. And if you're investing in, it's not just one country, you're investing in, you know, Nigeria and Thailand. And I mean, it must be very difficult.
Yeah, so if you are a pure stock picking fundamental researcher, that's just impossible, right? To manage an EM portfolio well is impossible. Right? Too many countries in there and they're too far to get to. And you know, frankly, the cost and effort would discourage most firms from doing a particularly good job, right? So being more data-driven, being more systematic, you know, quantitative, means you say, hey, look, I'm going to do as good of a job as possible based on available data that I can buy, that I can gather. And I'm going to build a model off of like, you know, well, how did China develop? Well, how did Japan develop? You know, how did Korea develop? And how did some countries not develop? And how can we sort of apply these models and, you know, look at what's happening in Brazil, right? Look at what's happening in Saudi Arabia and see if I find patterns. You know, history doesn't repeat perfectly, but it sure rhymes a lot, right? And so we can see what's happening in China right now and go, you know, that feels a lot like what Taiwan went through, right? That feels a lot like Japan went through, right? You look at BYD, right? BYD today is not that different than Toyota in the 70s, right? Toyota in the 70s was like the worst car you could buy, lowest quality, right? And it could only get into like, you know, poor part of Europe and Middle East because, you know, that was the market that was willing to buy from them because they had no brand and no quality just yet. And that's where BYD is today, right? No one knows who they are, right? They got to go in with a low price strategy and gradually their quality, their low price will start to convert people and they'll build some brand. And then it'll be a long time before they can come into the US and the US will have some incumbent automaker that tries to, you know, stop Toyota back in the 80s, just as they will try to prevent BYD from coming in. So it's, you know, it's the same script.
You said questions earlier about we could ask the model, how did China do what it did? How is that similar to Japan? Those to me seem like questions that a human being would ask another human being. How do you get the Excel spreadsheet or, you know, the Python to give answers and insight on those seemingly non-quantitative, very qualitative matters?
And this is where the word quantamental comes in, right? You want to use data to inform you, right? But you got to be intelligent and say, well, what data do I use? A lot of people just say, I want to use, you know, as much data as I can, right? Like the people who are trying to study the S&P today by saying, wow, I can look at US data going back to the 1800s. It's like, yes, that is more data, but it's not useful data, right? This is some...
Yeah, there was no Apple in 1890. Yeah. It was a bunch of railroads that lost money.
Yeah. So you want to use some human intelligence to say, if I'm going to look at data, right, what is actually informative data? And so this would be like, oh, if I want to study China, do I go and look at, you know, Chinese stock market data from, you know, 1992 through 2000, you know, which probably is when there are very few stocks and not a lot of liquidity? Or do I look at, you know, Japan or Taiwan or South Korea when they're about to enter the MSCI and had tremendous retail trading, right? That's probably where, if you look at that data and you say, machine learning, go fit the model to that data, the calibrated parameters will make more sense for you to then apply to the China model than trying to calibrate the data, you know, using, you know, 1992 China data.
And what are some data inputs, so the key data inputs to your models that, you know, attempt to make predictive price algorithms? You know, so on a company-wide, you mentioned quality. So I assume that's like free cash flow growth, profit margins, that kind of stuff, you know, low debt or low debt to equity, something like that. But on a country level, what are the different inputs? And I imagine, you know, in the 1990s, a lot of, Western investors got very bullish on emerging market countries because they had high growth, but high growth does not always equal high stock market performance. In the case of China or in the case of Malaysia, you know, or many other emerging market, Thailand, Indonesia, stuff, places like that. What are the sort of qualitative, you know, for lack of a better word, quantamental macro drivers of it's okay, you know, oh, you know, this country is growing at 10%, but actually it's not bullish. It's not bullish growth. Whereas this country is only growing at 5%, but it's actually, you know, the fundamentals are very solid.
So, you know, even though there's not a lot of sort of macro thinking and macro variables that go into, you know, building models, selecting models, it then sort of cascade that down and you apply that information to look at individual stocks from a, you know, bottom-up perspective, right? And so all the macro information will sort of filter through and be expressed in terms of companies within industries and sort of industries against other industries. And so I would say, like you say, right, because if you look at pure macro, you run into this risk of you can have periods of strong GDP growth, but with bad stock market performance, right? We've seen that over and over again, right? It just says, look, macro is one variable and it has to interact with many things at the industry and the company level. And so ultimately, you can only make money by selecting the right companies, right? The right companies in the context of that macro backdrop.
So you don't use your models to select a country allocation top-down. You start with the company-wide analysis and then the country allocation is what it is based on that.
Correct. Yes. Now, again, you're going to generally, you know, create country overweights or underweights that make sense, right? Because, you know, usually it's the great companies in that country that, you know, will be sort of world-leading in terms of its sort of industry capability, and that leads the country overweight or underweight.
Has your model gotten more bullish on Chinese companies and, you know, their allocation to China has grown, not because they're looking at anything in the macro data, but just because the companies are getting cheaper relative to other ones?
Yeah, so certainly valuation is a big driver. But in terms of our biggest overweights right now, our biggest overweight right now is we have a big overweight into the blue chip state-owned enterprises. And that's simply because if you kind of look at their relative valuation, given the kind of risk they have, they look like they have almost a, you know, a downside insurance provided by the government. And so you only get upside capture. So given the valuation, given the low risk, they become very attractive for the model.
Okay, so that's very interesting because I know, you know, often sometimes investors say, oh, I'll invest in Chinese companies X the state-owned enterprise. And you're saying, no, what we're most bullish on in China is the state-owned enterprises. they must be they, right now at this very juncture, you know, we're recording this, you know, late March 2024. So I guess that goes to the real governance question of, you know, if you own a company in the US or the UK, like that company, you know, may not have the best management, but generally they are trying to advocate for shareholders and they're trying to increase, you know, their earnings, which hopefully they will pay to you in buybacks or dividends. And I think, you know, Western investors, part of the reason maybe a lot of Western investors pulled out of the market, or I should say non-Chinese investors, is because there's a sense that no, you know, there's a risk that this will be nationalized. What do I really own here? And I think probably that sense of risk may be at its greatest with the state-owned enterprises. So what do you really own here if you own a state-owned enterprise? And is your answer based on, you know, what your models are say, or your individual research?
A lot of our top-down research do become our models that goes then into stock selection. For example, so we had the same thesis, which is like, boy, everyone hates state-owned enterprises. And I can understand why you would hate state-owned enterprises, right? Like the political interference is one thing, right? And just the fact that it's viewed as a, just to say, look, it feels like it's the DMV that somehow became a listed company, right? And so you just don't feel like it's going to be very efficient, right? People are not incentivized to do a great job or create profits. So we went into it with the same suspicion. But when we look closer, and so we actually went and bought data, and then we realized, wow, you know, there's a lot of data. You can classify state-owned enterprises into centrally connected, those that are sort of operated directly by Beijing, to the, you know, local municipality connected. And what you see is, like, if you look at the municipality connected state-owned enterprise, so there's like a smaller local state-owned enterprise, like the performance is abysmal, right? It's exactly what you predict, right? It's probably the mayor and all of his family being hired and paid egregious, you know, salaries, right? And it's just not productive. And then you look at the centrally connected Beijing operated state-owned enterprises, like they have better efficiency ratio than anyone else. And their management doesn't actually even make a lot of money. And if they make any mistake, they don't pay, you know, growing dividends, they just get fired and replaced by someone else. So we realize, wow, you know, that's really good governance, right? Because your largest shareholder wants you to grow earnings and wants you to pay dividends. And if you fail to deliver that, you just get fired, right? So there's no entrenchment problem. So it's actually quite surprising when we saw that data. And so we actually now, after looking at the data and seeing it repeat over so many cycles, we have very strong confidence that, okay, like the Beijing control state-owned enterprise are so visible. They're almost like the face of the Communist Party. Like it's a testament of stewardship. And so when they underperform, Beijing has to fire people because you now have embarrassed the government and then your incompetence is on display. And then you're replaced by someone. The next guy would go, hey, you know, I better do a really good job. I don't want to get fired. And so where this is not true is, of course, in the, you know, small local municipalities where Beijing doesn't have transparency.
So you're not bullish on the regional one so much as the literally Beijing, the Chinese Communist Party. So what would some examples be of state Communist Party Chinese, you know, by Beijing companies, state-owned enterprises?
One of the easiest telltale signs is if the name of the company starts with China, like only if you're directly managed by Beijing, can your company name start with China? It was something I learned. It's like, oh, you know, when I register a company, can I just call it China something? No, like you cannot register any trademark, any name that starts with the name China, because it immediately communicates.
China State Construction is PetroChina a state-owned enterprise?
Yep.
Yeah. What kind of dividend yields are we talking about here?
Yeah. So we're often looking at dividend yields that are right now many of them have dividend yields higher than your bank deposit rate, right? That's how attractive they are. Right? So you could easily find someone who's paying like 4.5%, and like the bank deposit yield right now is like 2%, right? So that's a pretty good deal.
So outside of China, what is your biggest overweight in the emerging market world? And I should also say that, you know, again, you're not choosing that. You're starting with the companies first, as we said before. But what is your biggest country overweight and why?
Yeah, so I would say the we have probably two. The biggest country overweight is Mexico for us, yeah. Right? And, you know, a lot of that is, you know, we are seeing the early day benefits of, you know, sort of friendshoring to Mexico, you know, whether it's now the US is buying more from Mexico, and that's sort of starting to show up in the Mexican export data, or you got China exporting a lot more to Mexico as sort of a trade through station where, you know, Chinese factories are moving to Mexico and they need a lot of intermediate materials, you know, to come from China into Mexico. You're seeing, you know, even, you know, Taiwan and Korea exporting more to Mexico, because again, now the components don't go to China, they go directly to Mexico. So you're actually seeing that in trade data. You're seeing that show up in export-oriented firms and the sectors that supports that.
What's your biggest underweight, or maybe, you know, what do you think is kind of the most overrated within the emerging markets?
I would say, so this is not a structural underweight, and I want to be super, super clear about that, because it was our big overweight to start with. You know, so India was a big overweight for us a while back. It's gone to a minor underweight, because everyone just got too enthusiastic about India. And, you know, is India going to grow? Absolutely, right? But I don't think India becomes China, right? I don't think India replaces China as the world's factory. And that's evidenced by, like, Foxconn, the world's biggest contract manufacturer, you know, went to India, plowed in billions and billions of dollars, and they still struggle to make the latest iPhone, right? So the iPhones made in India are not sold in the US. The iPhones made in India are kind of the lower spec older models. So they've just struggled with quality and also labor efficiency. And it's just because India is not positioned to be a manufacturer, right? It is positioned to be, you know, the world's greatest software outsourcing, call center outsourcing, right? Because their advantage is software development, right? Their advantage is their natural language is English. So they can, you know, do commerce well with the rest of the world. So that's not an advantage in a you know, factory floor. So so I think people got a little carried away thinking somehow, just because India has a lot of population comparable to, you know, comparable in size to China, that India will just become the world's factory and all the factory will move to India. So I think there was some unrealistic enthusiasm around that theme. And so, you know, when India made new highs, we sort of eased off.
Jason, I know we talked a lot about China, but I just want to know, I know you've talked about a Beijing put, and specifically, can you talk about the mechanics of how the Chinese Communist Party will assist the U.S., the Chinese stock market? And I know you wrote about how, you know, money is being forced out of real estate and bank deposit products into wealth management, and how this could be fuel for the stock market. Tell us about how the CCP, you know, might assist the Chinese equity market via a Beijing put, and in a way that's direct, not just, you know, lowering the interest rate by 5 basis points, or, you know, putting out a press release that says some nice things, but actually, you know, redirecting billions and billions and hundreds of billions of dollars into the equity market and doing stuff like that, as well as the Bloomberg news that maybe some Chinese state-owned enterprises would use their cash reserves to buy stocks. I mean, how do you feel about that as the owner of many Chinese state-owned enterprises?
Yeah, so I'll talk about the second channel that you just talked about, which is like state-owned enterprises buying. I mean, I literally witnessed that, right? I was at lunch and someone got a call, and it was essentially, like, you know, sort of Beijing calling a major state-owned investment fund, asking, well, you know, what's been your buying activity? What have you bought today? Right? So it does actually happen, but it's not unique to China, right? Like, you know, one of our big clients, the big pension fund in Taiwan, they also do that. They do countercyclical buying, meaning when the market falls a lot, the government is under a lot of pressure, and they would sort of jump in with a government reserve fund. Now, in China, both you have the National Social Security Fund, which is a pretty big monster, right? You got the Sovereign Wealth Fund. You also have a lot of regional and provincial investment funds, industry funds that historically are meant to provide, really, you know, private equity and venture capital money to support industry development. But, you know, those are very, very well funded, often overfunded, because, you know, these deals have all become quite valuable once they go IPO. So they're sitting on a lot of cash. So they're basically buying, right? They're basically buying at a market low. Now, the question is, you know, does this do enough? It certainly is a great signal when you're actually buying rather than just saying, oh, you know, the economy is going to be great, right? So it's not cheap talk anymore when the government's actually buying. And what you're seeing is years to date, right? These government-owned mega cap stocks have outperformed the broad market by quite a bit. If you look at kind of the small cap, which are more private companies versus the large cap performance, like this year, I think the differential is probably closer to 10%, right? That's how much, like, the large cap state owned enterprises have done. So this first part, right, directly government in the short run could just buy. And they've done so historically in countercyclical buying. And funny thing is, they actually do make good money, right? Because that's like the Warren Buffett, you know, approach, right? Buy when everyone's fearful, and that's what they're doing. Now, the other piece I think that's probably more significant in the long run is, you know, the Chinese bureaucrats, you know, bureaucrats in Beijing, you know, one thing that does trouble them is they realize people think of their stock market, right? Their domestic retail investors think of their own stock market as a casino, right? It doesn't have a lot of good price discovery quality, right? It doesn't get long-term capital to, you know, companies that actually have great product, great innovators, right? And so, you know, capital can go randomly into thematic stocks, fraudulent stocks, and then that's clearly not good for long-term development, right? So they want long-term capital. But if all you have is brokerage, right? You know, it's not in broker's best interest that you buy a stock and hold it forever, right? They just want you to trade, right? And so there's so much like themes and stories that brokers constantly try to sell you. So, well, the regulator, and so they actually promoted this guy whose nickname is the broker butcher, right? Wu Qing, to be the new regulator, the head of the regulator. It's like, look, we want wealth management. We do not want just brokerage day trading, right? That's not what the industry should be about. And so there's this big push, like, all the banks got major KPIs, like you need to convert a fraction of the deposits, the shadow banking stuff, into wealth management, which is supposed to be long-term diversified portfolio that can be, you know, managed by rational portfolio managers that supply long-term, you know, price discovery capital to bring order to the stock market. Again, that's the ambition. That's the aspiration. It's probably going to take a long time to get there. But, you know, sometimes China has shown the ability to sort of get there really fast. Because they've seen all the examples of, you know, good policymaking, bad policymaking from other countries.
So the two elements of the Beijing put, the second thing you just mentioned is the bureaucrats encouraging bank deposits to be converted to wealth management products. So, you know, a 60-40 portfolio, but, you know, something that includes stocks. The first one is, what are the, you know, large Chinese institutional investors allocating towards the stock market? Did you say it was the Chinese pension system or the state-owned enterprises or...
So it's basically across the board, right? It's both from their social security fund. It's okay. Also their regional investment funds and their industry investment funds. They're all jumping in.
And then where does the People's Bank of China play? Does that have a large, you know, impact? You know, when the People's Bank of China lowers interest rates, is that seen as stimulative for the stock market or
no? Really? So again, we can't take the American lens to understand the sort of Chinese monetary policy. Like, in the U.S., right, when we lower interest rate, everyone's cost of capital lowers, you know, cost of financing lowers. So we go spend money, we go borrow money, right? That's not in China. And you see that in Japan as well. So this is not just something weird about the Chinese, right? This is true of the Japanese as well. When the bank lowers interest rate, what happens is because everyone saves so excessively, right? A big part of their disposable income is bank interest, right? So if you lower their bank interest, all of a sudden they feel really poor. They don't spend money, right? So in China, when the government lowers your interest rate, you are actually quite angry and you stop spending money. We saw that in Japan, right? So it's not how it works in the US. Right? You can't just transpose that and say that's how it works in China. So the Chinese government is very reluctant to just lower interest rate because they know, look, you know, I might be lowering costs of finance for some people, but broadly, I'm making households feeling poor and they don't spend money, and that's just bad for everyone. So generally, their policy is much more fiscal rather than monetary, right? It literally is the government has to go and spend money.
The government has to go, yeah, fiscal. There we go. Jason, thanks so much for being so generous with your time and insights. I've definitely learned a lot. I know my audience has as well. Where can people find you and learn more about Raelient?
Absolutely. So please find me on LinkedIn. I don't use X. I only use LinkedIn. I'm probably a little too old school for that. So find me on LinkedIn, connect with me, and subscribe to my newsletter, The Bridge. And you know, I hope to sort of bridge you, be the bridge for you and, you know, the different emerging economies to learn more about, you know, Taiwan, Korea, China, India. Lean on us as your source of information about emerging markets.
That's great. You don't have Twitter. You don't have X. I'm kind of jealous of you. As I mentioned today, my Twitter got hacked over this weekend. And for 5 days, I did not have access to my Twitter account, which was really bad. But I just want to say on the record now for my audience, I do have access to my Twitter account. So if you see me posting and, you know, that is really me, just to be very clear. So thank you, everyone, for watching. And thanks again, Jason, for coming on.
It's a pleasure, Jack.
Thanks for watching. Remember to check out vaneck.com/HODLFG to learn more about the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, ticker HODL. A reminder that forward guidance episodes are available on all podcast apps and on Twitter, where I post them regularly at JackFarley96. Thanks again. Until next time.